Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to a late night Wednesday edition of the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by a first timer who it's weird just talking to him before we get started because I've listened to him in my earballs for like I don't know what time is anymore. It's been several years now. It's Trayvon Edwards. Trey, good evening, sir. How are you?
What's going on, man? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, man. I appreciate you signing on for an hour and a half mailbag style podcast tonight.
Yeah. You know, like you DM me and hit me and I was like, yeah, I'll do it.
Well, I appreciate it. We won't go an hour and a half. It's late for both of us. Us 30 Club. I'm not there yet, but I will be there this weekend. I'm excited for it. I wanted to have you on tonight because you are very familiar with the Brooklyn Nets. You're very familiar with the Bucks. I have gotten in a lot of arguments about this. There's a lot of ways of looking at the top three in the East right now. We just saw the Nets Sixers tonight. A lot of people pulling a lot from that. But when you look at the top three in the East and you think about how it's going to go, because by just with the way the playoffs will shake out, it seems very unlikely that we don't get those top three and making it second round and see what happens. But if you had to just kind of do a power rankings of this top three and how you would separate them, how would you do it, Trey?
I got Philly at one, Brooklyn two. I guess Milwaukee three.
How did you come to that?
I mean, Philly's playing exceptional basketball. They've been the most consistent despite Joel going down. You know, they're clicking at all cylinders. They're making the right plays. Doc's coaching these guys into the right direction. Tobias Harris is playing like a snubbed all-star. You know, Seth Curry's shooting the ball well. Joel Embiid's playing like an MVP. Easy call.
I'm fascinated by you picking them because, like, I have it a little bit differently. Like, I have the Nets as a head and shoulders one, health permitting. KD just comes back and it's just seamless to get 34 for him, and it's insane how he can just come in and immediately just be back to KD. But, like, they're even getting stuff out of, like, Claxton and Johnson, who I'd forgotten, like, outplayed Michael Porter Jr. in Adidas camp years ago. And he's going to be a sneaky, interesting piece for them. And they're closing five and what Kyrie is doing and James Harden, just what he's been this year and being an MVP candidate. I'm just like, you're not going to be able to beat this team four times in a series. Like, I don't know. Like, when you think about the matchup of the Sixers and Nets, if it comes to that, what makes you think that the Sixers have enough offensive firepower to beat the Nets four times?
It's kind of hard to tell. It's based on health and availability. At the moment, I mean, obviously you want to root for the Brooklyn Nets if they have the big three. But if they don't, it's a tough matchup. I think all guys would do the best that they can to be available for this series if they did match up, which makes it very hard for the Sixers. So, realistically, if both teams were healthy, I'm gonna go with the Nets.
See, that's the whole thing, is like, what with the health, and who do you think is the most important to, like, let's just say that they're not gonna have 100% of their big like health wise all three will be 100%. If you had to rank the importance of their health and where they should, like, the best case scenario, or like what they could still be at and still get through, how would you do that?
Can you repeat the question? Sorry.
So basically, like, with Harden the tread, like, do they need 100% Harden, 100% KD, and 60% Kyrie? Is that enough to get through the Sixers, or do you think it's like 100% Kyrie, 100% Harden, and 60% KD to get by? Like, how would you differentiate the level of health for those three necessary to beat the Sixers in a 7-game series?
I don't even think that it's like 100% or anything like that. I think that guys just need to be available and playing their best ball game and making shots. Again, Sixers just have the chemistry. Sixers are just playing well, and I won't take that from them, although the Nets are the favorites, you know. But overall, you know, after tonight's game, you know, the bench even with the Nets being, you know, shorthanded, they competed and played hard and gave the Sixers a game. So if you implement, you know, the big three in the situation, like, I don't think the Sixers have a choice or a chance, more so.
Is Joel Embiid your MVP?
Yeah, unless Jokic gets hurt.
Let's hope not, man. Jamal Murray stuff sucks. And I don't know if you saw Baxter Holmes' piece on ESPN.com tonight, but injuries, it's like the second highest of in NBA history of all-stars who've spent a lot of time on the injured list. It's a problem. And the grind for a lot of these guys over the last year, it's concerning. And I'm worried the playoffs is just going to be even more with just the intensity ramping up and rotation slimming down, and I don't know. I think it's going to be... I'm terrified of another big name star. As a Hawks guy, I've watched a lot of Bogey this year, and I've watched a lot of what he's doing with this Hawks team, and Bogey's just shooting lights out. He's just been great since coming back. If that trade goes through for Milwaukee, and Bogey is a Milwaukee Buck, do you think that changes how they are, and do you think that's something that's going to really... No, not at all?
No.
Okay, so he was not the final fifth piece. He's not the guy. You're not worried about that spot.
No. No, everything happened for a reason. I like the Bucks. I like the pickups that they made, adding P.J. Tucker, Drew Holiday, you know, and adding, you know, guys to fill out their roster. And they did get better, I will say, and they're playing good basketball. But I just don't – I still don't even think they're good enough to even beat the Heat.
Really?
Yeah, no.
So what does that mean for Bud? Let's just say, like, they fall to a four or five spot. If they fall in the four spot and the Hawks pass them, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think there's enough time for the Hawks to make up that ground. But, like, if they don't get by, they get curb stomped by the Nets in round two. Is that it for Bud?
Probably. He might be in the hot seat. He might be in the hot seat. But, you know, overall, I ain't thinking too much of it. You know what I mean? Coach Bud is a good coach, but he's a bit stubborn and sticks to his game plan.
What are you most excited about heading into the playoffs with this group? Is there anything outside of the big three that interests you come playoff time in the East, or do you think it's just like, let's speed this up and get to this?
Nah, I'm fine with it. I mean, it's a short season, something put together, and obviously just trying to make something work. Teams are still trying to figure things out, and guys are still trying to stay healthy, and we've had tons of injuries this season, and we'll get to the playoffs when we get to the playoffs. I'm just really not that adamant for a series to start. So however it lines up, I'm sure it'll be a good one.
Yeah. So when you look up to the West and you look at the Lakers, you look at where they're at, you look at the Clippers and them streaking right now, you look at Paul George's toe, you look at Ty Lue being in there. How do you have the West right now? Do you think what is your pecking order in the top of the West?
I'm not even sure who's first right now. I want to say Denver. Is Denver first?
Even without Murray.
Yeah. I mean, hold on 1 second. Utah. Okay, respectfully. Phoenix, Clippers, Denver, the Lakers. Out of these eight, I'm going to go L.A.
Which L.A.?
Both.
Okay.
And I'm going to go Utah. And that was my three.
See, I have Phoenix in that three. I have L.A. and
Phoenix is cool, but I don't see Phoenix beating Utah.
Interesting. See, I don't. Who's Utah throwing at Devin Booker and Chris Paul in crunch time? Who are they throwing at him?
It's not consistent enough, though. It's not consistent. Devin Booker's first playoff game, Chris Paul.
Having Chris Paul will help.
Having Chris Paul will help, but I don't think it's the end-all, be-all, you know?
I don't know. Utah, like, they're going to get hit. They saw pick-and-roll basketball. They saw the pick-and-drop. But, like, I think they're going to run into the problem against either of the two LA teams where Kawhi and Paul George, like, they just have no answers. Like, Joe Ingles, I'm really mad at Utah for just doubling down and betting on their rotation, their wing rotation with Bojan and friends. And I think that's going to, I'm not sure they could have gotten a Lou Dort or a Jeremy Grant or whoever, but, like, them not going all in with the kind of season that they're having and not adding some sort of wing, premier wing, at the deadline, I think is going to ultimately cost them, because we're going to look at it and we're going to go, oh, this team's like, there's no answer for Kawhi and Paul George, and the Clippers are just going to run them out of the building. I have the Clippers winning it all. I think the Clippers are turning the corner. If Paul George is healthy, I think this Clippers team actually feels like, I'm betting on Clippers Nets and Clippers in like 6 or 7 right now. What is your finals right now?
I mean, in a perfect world, I want the Nets.
I think the NBA wants the Nets.
NBA wants the Nets and Lakers, to be honest.
Yeah, but Lakers, I don't bet on both of them being okay. Like LeBron and AD. And the AD stuff scares the crap out of me. Like, that stuff just seems like a ticking time bomb. And I don't know. I just think it's going to be really hard for them to go back-to-back and run the gauntlet with this group and with where they're at injury-wise. I think it's just going to be significantly more difficult. And just what they went through last year, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. It's LeBron James, but I'm not penciling them in. I just think it's going to ask so much of LeBron and AD to go back to back. I think it's just going to be that much more difficult. And the West, I think, is better this year than it was last year. So we'll see. Trey, what can we check out from you across The Athletic, Count the Dings, WKNYC? Like, what would you like to plug as we wrap up here late on a Wednesday night?
I'm going to just stick to the podcast platforms. Catch me on Count the Dings, Growing Up the Same, BOMMOG. You also can catch me on the Athletic podcast, Basket Buds, and then also the NBA Daily Ding.
Well, keep up the great work. It's so weird that we're doing this podcast because I'm just so used to listening to you every week on the NBA podcast. So it's been awesome having you on, man. I greatly appreciate you making the time, especially with being late. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Keep up the good work.
All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by Bradley Smith of Cat Scratch Reader, a rival blog for the Carolina Panthers of my near and dear Atlanta Falcons. Bradley, good evening, sir. How are you?
I am pretty good. How are you?
I'm good, man. So it's been a few days now since your Panthers traded for Sam Darnold, the former New York Jet. Now that you've had a couple days to think about it, think about what they gave up, think about the future, think about what he's been in 3 years in New York, where are you at with the trade, and what are your expectations for Sam Darnold in Carolina?
I actually like the trade. I don't think that the Panthers gave up too much. You know, I mean, yeah, we gave up a future second-round pick, but I mean, you know, giving up a fourth rounder, a sixth rounder, and a second rounder may seem like a lot for a guy who hasn't really been that good and has arguably been one of the worst quarterbacks in the league. But I look at it this way. I mean, he's been with Adam Gase for the last 2 years on one of arguably the worst roster in NFL history on the Jets. He's only 23 years old, man. I mean, he still has some untapped potential, I think. And I think in a right situation, I think he could actually be pretty good. I do think that Joe Brady and Matt Rhule will be able to get more out of him than the Jets were able to. And I think that if he's at least a capable, decent, mediocre, middle-of-the-road starting quarterback, then giving up a second round pick as the biggest piece of that trade will be well worth it. Cause I mean, you know, when you look at what their other options were, I mean, they offered the number 8 overall pick for Matthew Stafford. They were in on the Deshaun Watson trade opportunity before his off the field situation happened. And, you know, they've talked about moving up in the draft, and it would have cost a whole lot more than what they traded to the Jets to move up in the draft. So I think when you look at it you know, from a value perspective, I think it's hard to really complain too much.
Do you think they should still take a quarterback if they like one of them that falls to 8 potentially?
I think it depends. You know, I don't think they should take somebody like Mac Jones or, you know, anybody below that at number 8. But if somebody like Justin Fields, for example, you know, Joe Brady was at his pro day today to get a look at him. If he falls to number 8 somehow, which I don't think is going to happen, but if he does, then yes, I think they should take a quarterback at 8. You know, they haven't picked up Sam Darnold's fifth-year option yet, so essentially they have him for 1 year on a rookie contract. So they should continue to evaluate the quarterback position and have a backup plan in case Darnold really isn't that good. And getting a guy like Justin Fields on a rookie deal seems like a good idea. Now, I don't think they should reword. I do think that if you know, Trevor Lawrence is going number 1, he's out of the equation. Zach Wilson's probably going number 2, so he's out of it too. If Trey Lance and Justin Fields are both gone by the time the Panthers pick at number 8, I think they should address either offensive tackle, wide receiver, tight end, you know, something else. But if one of those two guys is there, then yeah, they absolutely should probably take him.
Do you think this is a 1-year tryout for Sam Darnold, or do you think the Panthers saw something, Brady saw something, Rule saw something, this new front office saw something that makes them believe that this is their franchise guy and he's got a longer leash than maybe we're all expecting?
I think that really depends on how the draft goes. They have until May the 3rd to decide what they want to do with the fifth-year option.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think if they can get somebody like Justin Fields, they'll evaluate Darnold as a 1-year tryout and then just trade the one they decide they don't want to keep. But if they can't get a quarterback in the draft and they have to go other positions, I think they'll pick up that option. It's $18.5 million. So it's a lot of money on a guy you haven't even seen in your offense yet. But, you know, it's less money than they're going to pay Teddy Bridgewater to be a backup if they keep him on the roster. So I don't know if they'll sign him long-term, but I do think we will see him at least 2 years. I don't think they would have traded the picks that they traded just to have him for 1 year.
The offensive line around him, what do you think he's going to be up against here? Is it an improvement from New York? The Panthers, kind of a sneaky... It had a sneaky good offensive line, and Rule's really good at coaching offensive lines. Do you think it's a situation with that, with McCaffrey, with the guys outside, losing Samuel, do you think this is enough for Sam Darnold to succeed, especially, too, considering just what the NFC South is with Tampa Bay, New Orleans, and then the gigantic wild card that is the Falcons, and just the NFC as a whole is just, I think, the deeper, more difficult conference right now. What do you think? Do you think that this is, like, Sam should thrive, or do you think that there are real concerns where you're like, this might be out of his hands?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think he will be better than he was in New York. I mean, it's hard for him to be much worse, but you have to consider, I mean, his best players, his best receivers – in New York, I mean, we're talking like Braxton Berrios was like his number 2 or number 3 wide receiver. I mean, that's the extent of and what he had. I mean, he didn't really have an elite tight end. He didn't have a young, multifaceted weapon at running back like Christian McCaffrey is. He didn't have a guy like DJ Moore. He had Robbie Anderson for 1 year in New York, and they were really good together. They're going to be reunited in Carolina. We don't really have an elite tight end in Carolina, at least not yet. Hopefully we'll be able to draft Kyle Pitts in the first round and fix that. But, you know, I think the offensive line in Carolina is better than what he had in New York. I think Christian McCaffrey is far and away better than any player on the Jets. It's not even really close. So I think we're really going to find out the answer to the question of, was it the Jets or was it that Sam Darnold just isn't good enough to be in the NFL. And I think he is good enough to be in the NFL, and I think that's why Matt Rhule wanted to trade for him. So I don't think he's going to be, you know, franchise quarterback, savior of the world type guy. I don't think he's going to be Tom Brady or Peyton Manning or, you know, anything like that. But I think if he can be on that, you know, Matthew Stafford, Matt Ryan, Ben Roethlisberger,
Rodney,
you know,
Pete,
that type of, yeah, that type of
Kerry
level.
Collins.
Yeah, I mean, it's
I'm just
not
naming
hard
some Panthers
to,
guys. That's what's happening,
yeah,
right,
it's not hard to be one of the best quarterbacks in Panthers history.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking Jake Delhomme and Cam Newton are, you know, the top two on the list, and it's not hard to be number three. So
it's probably not Jimmy Clausen. You know,
yeah. I mean, if he's Jimmy Clausen, then yeah, we can say that we made a mistake trading for him. But I mean, I don't think he's going to be too much worse than Teddy Bridgewater was. I don't think he's going to be. I don't think he can be worse than he was in New York.
Yeah.
So I think they'll get the value out of the trade out of him, even if he only plays there 1 year.
What has Matt Rhule gotten right thus far in his tenure as head coach in Carolina, and what has he gotten wrong thus far?
That's a hard question to answer, to be honest with you. One of the things I think he got right is he has installed a culture of working hard and not quitting. You know, the Panthers were 5-11 last year, but 8 of their 11 losses were by one score. So, I mean, we stayed close in games. We didn't get blown out a lot. It was a young team. We fought to the bitter end in a lot of games. And, I mean, you know, we were 0-8 in games where we had a chance to win in the fourth quarter. And thanks, Teddy Bridgewater, for that. But, you know, I think he is – for the first year, and especially with the world as it is, you know, with COVID going on and all that, and him having limited practice opportunity and limited contact opportunity, I think he did a hell of a job, even though we only won 5 games. I do think that he is relying a little bit too much on people he's worked with in the past. I know every coach does that. But if you look at our roster, there's a lot of guys that went to either Temple or Baylor. And there's a lot of coaches that he's worked with before. And I don't know if it's going to be a major problem, but one of the things that sealed Ron Rivera's fate was that he relied too much on people that were in his inner circle. Like, he wouldn't make changes to the coaching staff when it was necessary to do so. And I'm worried that, you know, Matt Rhule is going to fall under that same trap. We released Zach Kerr, and I know that doesn't really break the news in the NFL, but, you know, we saved $1.3 million in cap space to cut a veteran defensive tackle to keep a guy who, because he went to Baylor. And, you know, things like that, I think, could lead to issues down the line. And I would say that's probably his biggest weakness right now. I mean, you know, he's a first-year coach, so he hasn't really had too many opportunities to screw up yet.
What are you most looking for out of this new front office for this draft, and where you would like to see them invest in?
I really, 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 really hope we see them give whoever, Sam Darnold, you know, Justin Fields, whoever, give them a chance by giving them a left tackle and giving them a cohesive offensive line. I mean, we haven't had a starting left tackle worth having since Jordan Gross retired. And Jordan Gross retired in 2014. I mean, We haven't had any consistency there. And I know every fan base complains about their left tackle, but, you know, we've got to solve the offensive line problem. I mean, it caused Cam Newton to wither away in his last 2 years here because he couldn't, there was no protection for him. And it's, it's not really the main reason that Teddy Bridgewater wasn't what we wanted him to be, but there was a contributing factor in that. You know, nobody can really be a successful quarterback when you don't have time to step up into the pocket and make reads. Like, it's impossible to do. And I would like to see this new front office value protecting the quarterback more than the previous one did.
Interesting. What do you think they ultimately do with the number 8 pick?
I think they'll do one of two things. They will either draft a quarterback or trade down.
Mm. Even if Pitts is there at 8, potentially. Or Penei Sewell.
Okay, yeah. If I think they do have a list, you know, a short list like every team does. If Penei Sewell or Pitts are there, I think they'll draft. But if it's not them or one of the two, Trey Lance or Justin Fields, if it's not one of those four guys, I think they'll try to trade down. Now, that doesn't mean they'll be able to, because, you know, to trade down, somebody has to want to trade up. And by that time, I mean, nobody needs over anybody else, because all the quarterbacks will be gone. So, it's anybody's guess, but if I had to put money on it, I would say they'll draft one of those four players or trade down. They'll try to trade out to, you know, somewhere in the teens and still pick up somebody like Rashawn Slater that would be a good fit.
How would you rate the NFC South hierarchy going into 2021? We'll wrap up here, Bradley.
I can't say that the Bucs aren't the team to beat. I mean, they're the repeating, you know, they're Super Bowl champions.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
they didn't win the division last year. That's why it's so difficult. Like, they didn't even win the division, the Saints.
They didn't even win the division, and they won the Super Bowl, and they brought back all of their roster. So I think they're the best team. I think the Saints, the Falcons, and the Panthers, I think you could literally flip a coin.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Drew Brees is gone, thankfully. so I don't know what we're going to get with the Saints. I don't know if Jameis Winston is going to be their guy or if Taysom Hill is going to be their guy, because it's impossible to figure that out, and I think it changes their team and their outlook, depending on which way they go. I think Jameis would be better. I think he's a better quarterback than Taysom Hill. But, you know, they're second or third, and the Falcons and Panthers, as you know, it's a toss-up. It could literally be – both teams could be 12-4 fighting for the number one seed, and we could both win one game.
Like, yeah.
And you don't know which way it's going to go until, like, week 8. How it's going to be, and it's a toss-up. I mean, I think I would probably give the edge to the Falcons because, I mean, you know, we are still a very young team, and, I mean, Sam Darnold's a wild card, but the Falcons, they do have a pretty solid roster. I mean, Matt Ryan is still in his prime, as much as I hate to say it. But you still have Julio Jones, you have Calvin Ridley. I mean, you guys have talent on both sides of the ball, so I hate to say it, but I think you're probably, unless you do what you normally do and fail to live up to expectations. I think it's going to be close, though. I think, you know, the Bucs will run away with it. I think they'll win 12 games at least.
But see, and like, I don't know, man. Like, they didn't win 12 games last year, and Brady's a year older. And the Bucs are awesome. They had a great run. All that can be true. I don't know. There's still some lightning in a bottle type feeling there. And the Saints have been the better team for the last few years. And it's like, they still have the best coach in the division. They still have Armstead. They still have Ramczyk at the offensive tackle spots. They still have Michael Thomas. They still have Kamara. They still have a bunch of pieces on the defensive line. They still have a bunch of pieces everywhere. Like, they somehow are navigating the cap. Like, I'm still picking the Saints to win the division. Until, like, it actually happens and they fall apart, I can't bet against the Saints. And
I feel you.
If the Falcons go quarterback at 4, they're signaling, like, they're going to tear down, because the Falcons are in a cap situation where, like, if they go quarterback, that means they're just going to pseudo try this year and start really moving on from the Julios and the Ryans after this year, where I think it's going to get ugly quickly if they go quarterback, because that tells me that Fontenot's not going to invest everything and really drive this cap situation into troublesome territory if they go QB and don't give Matt Ryan help here. Like, I think that one can that will change very quickly. The Falcons will fall to the bottom very quickly. I think they're top heavy. They're not the deepest roster by any means, especially on defense. And then the Panthers, like you said, they're young, but a lot of skill position talent. You locked in your right tackle. You have talent on both sides of the ball, but I don't know. The Panthers are just also really well coached. So we don't know how Arthur Smith's going to be as a head coach. We know Matt Rhule is pretty good. We know Joe Brady, super smart and a lot of fun. And you got a new GM. So we'll see what he does in this owner and what his patience are, because it seems like Tepper doesn't have the most patience, and seems like
he does not. It scares me, because I feel like he's gonna turn into Jerry Jones. Like, yeah, it scares the crap out of me, and sometimes I'm just like, man, just be quiet and let the guys in the football side of it do their job, and you just make money. Like, let them do what they do, and you do what you do.
That usually doesn't happen.
You never
until
noticed,
years
the best
down the line.
Owners are the ones you never hear from.
Yeah. But he's also like, I just spent $1 billion on this team. Like, I'm not going to not have my fingerprints on it.
Yeah, I'm not going to not say anything. Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough,
Oh, and
man.
If the Falcons are smart, they'll take a quarterback, by the way.
We'll see. We'll see.
The thing is, though, is you can get Justin Fields or Trey Lance.
Yeah.
They're both better than anybody in next year's class.
Well, we say that before everything. Like, I don't know. Like, we'll see. Sam Howell might be incredible. Like, I
mean, what they should do is they should do what Green Bay did when they drafted Aaron Rodgers, because Matt Ryan's got, what, 3 years left on his contract before
they
can get
off
out
of
it
after next year. Like, they after did next some, year. It's going to
so,
hurt
yeah,
a little bit
draft
more.
Draft a guy, sit him behind Matt Ryan, pseudo go for it this year, let the Bucs have one last run with Brady, and let the Saints do what they're going to do, and then – you know, in 2022 and 2023, Carolina and Atlanta can take their spots back at the top two, and then the Bucks and Saints can go back to the bottom where they belong. You know, like, that's what I feel like's going to happen.
I don't know. I really
it's
cannot
so
tell you. I can tell you that there are so many smoke screens that, like, I have no idea what the Falcons are going to do. I have no idea what Terry Fontenot and Arthur Smith are going to do. No idea. They're all over the place. Nothing would surprise me with Atlanta. Nothing would surprise me.
I mean, if they're not going to take a quarterback, I would trade down, because there's plenty of teams.
Oh, they'll trade down. If you're not taking
the
quarterback, you're trading that number four spot for an absolute haul. And my fear is, like, all four of these guys are not going to work out. If you go four straight quarterbacks, at least two of them are going to bust. Like, we just know from
the
history, at least two.
Zach Wilson is going to bust. We can already
he's
going to the Jets.
I love Zach Wilson.
He's going to the Jets. Like, I don't think...
I don't think anybody
could be good on the Jets.
That's true. It's the Jets. That's a problem.
It's the Jets. Like, if the Jaguars took Zach Wilson instead of Trevor Lawrence, he would be fine.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm not even
Zach
sure about
Wilson
Trevor Lawrence.
Is not the problem. It's the Jets.
Yeah. Urban Meyer, we haven't seen him in the NFL. Like, I don't know what kind of NFL coach.
Yeah, that's going to be a disaster. That's going to be a dumpster fire.
I don't know. I really have
no
idea.
You can't out-recruit the NFL like you could do at Florida. Like, you can't just do – that doesn't work in the NFL.
No. I'm excited to at least see what it looks like, and I'm excited to
see
how
he handles. Oh, yeah, I can't wait. I mean, I can't wait to see it, but it's not going to end well.
Yeah, we shall see. Well, what can we check out from you and the great team at Cat Scratch Reader this week, Bradley?
Well, we are ramping up our draft coverage, because that – the big tentpole event that's going to be going on in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, stay tuned for that. We're going to be breaking down what we hope to do, to pick, and who, you know, who fits and who doesn't. And we'll have our usual recaps and reactions to every pick as they come out when the draft happens. And you can follow us along on catscratchreader.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at catscratchreader.
All right. Bradley, keep up the great work. Thank you so much for making the time tonight. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
All right, we're back. on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by Nathan Bond of the Daily Stampede, a very good USF blog that you should check out if you have not already. Nathan, good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Chase. Thanks for having me on. How are things with you?
Things are good. Things are good. Tennessee got their first in-state commitment and first commitment in the Josh Heupel era, so everything's great. Elijah Herring, just an all-pro. We got the next Henry Toa. Things are great. Tennessee's saved. FPI has them going bowling. Things could not be better on Rocky Top.
Yeah, and, you know, as a USF alum and, you know, cover USF, we were very sad to see that plate of donuts head to Tennessee. I'll be honest, and Josh Heupel. So, super unfortunate for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to the guy who's replacing Heupel at UCF. Because I think the USF job is extremely interesting. Because I think USF was kind of UCF before them. I still have a soft spot for the Matt Grothy era. One of my favorite college quarterbacks of all time, and just what USF was for me growing up and watching them, where things have fallen in recent years, and Blake Barnett's 19 years of college eligibility and all that great stuff. But you guys went out and you hired Jeff Scott. You pulled a Clemson guy because Tennessee tried to get Tony Elliott and were unsuccessful, and you pull the other OC, Jeff Scott. And I thought that was just like this under the radar thing where, like, yes, Gus Malzahn, sexier, Butch Davis, sexier name, you go Lane Kiffin, Willie Taggart. Jeff Scott doesn't have the same kind of just oomph, but like when I thought about it, I was like, Jeff Scott, this dude, he just knows offense. He's a dude who's waited his turn. He's already familiar with the area. He's going to get skill position guys in this area. I was just like, I could see a really easy path of USF coming back with Jeff Scott. But if you had to articulate like how year one went, or year zero, as we call all these new coaches when they take new jobs, of Jeff Scott at USF, how would you say it went? And do you think this still has the potential to be a, not a game changing hire, but just like a hire that gets USF back to where they were years ago?
I mean, it's a loaded question, right? I think we've been dubbing it year minus one, mm-hmm. Due to COVID, due to just the hole that Charlie Strong left. And I think that kind of goes down to, you know, you're one bad hire away from just crushing a program, right? It happened after Jim Leavitt was fired with Skip Holtz. Everybody thought, hey, home run hire. It didn't work out. And then it took Willie Taggart 2.5 years to figure it out. And then he bolted to Oregon. And then you bring in Charlie Strong and you have Quentin Flowers, who helps save the program a little bit, saves Willie's job in 2015. And you get just an absolute dud in Charlie Strong, and now Jeff Scott's rebuilding. The cupboard was pretty barren at nearly every single position when Jeff Scott took over. He made chicken salad out of, you know,
you
chicken
can curse
parts
in this podcast.
Okay, he made chicken salad out of chicken shit. It was shocking that they won a game. It's going to get better. He's a really good coach. He understands the quirks of the university. And as you mentioned, pulling a Clemson guy, it all comes down to athletic director Michael Kelly. He's an absolute wizard. He comes from the ACC. He's been part of the college football playoff committee. He's run a few Super Bowls. The guy has connections, and it really helps out when you have a leader who's in line with the president and the head coach of the football team. It's really starting to turn around here. I'm not going to go out on the limb and say USF's going to go to a bowl game this year, but you can see things are trending in the right direction.
So what are some things that are trending differently? And like when you brought up Willie Taggart and what he had to do to save this program temporarily, and it took him 2.5 years, and Clinton Flowers obviously helped there, but like what is he going to have to do differently than Taggart, and what did Taggart do in a similar way that Jeff Scott's already doing?
Recruit. Charlie Strong didn't recruit, and Jeff Scott has already kind of raised the bar recruiting-wise. There's a couple kids in this 2021 class that will be game-changers. Quarterback Timmy McClain out of Samford, the Orlando area, going into enemy territory and pulling one of the top quarterbacks in the state, plus his teammate Jimmy Horn, a wide receiver who was a late pickup for USF, and they had a battle of the likes. I believe it was Jackson's Jackson State, Alabama, Georgia. I think Tennessee was in there for Jimmy Horn. It was a really good pull for Jeff Scott, and that's kind of what you have to do. You have to hit on these guys your first full cycle, and it helped, you know, spring game being what it is, they hit on a quarterback, that's for sure. He's going to be the future. It's going to be interesting to see how everything else kind of shapes out, but you got to hit recruiting here in Florida, and they nailed it so far.
Do you think some of the things that's changed about USF in recent years versus a decade ago is just that, like, there's so many good programs now in the state of Florida, and there's so many different big-time programs that are pulling the best from Florida, and this is part of the reason that Florida State has struggled to get back to where they were in Miami, is that, like, it's just Clemson's in here now, Bama's in here now, Georgia's in here now. Like, there's just a lot more just premier programs that are pulling your best prospects, and it's just it's a lot more difficult to keep guys home than it used to be. But you have FAU, who's become a solid program. Butch Davis, that has brought FIU back. And you have Manny Diaz, who's a recruiting wizard at Miami. And now you have Mike Norvell, who I think has a lot of upside there at FSU and is doing a lot right. Now Gus and his pedigree at UCF. Like, you look up and down the list, and I'm like, man, it is just going to be brutal for Jeff Scott in this group to just go after these in-state guys, because there's just so much competition just around the Southeast and around the premier programs that are just going into Florida to get the best players.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. You know, even in the Bay Area, you know, Tampa Bay, it's, you know, encompasses like seven counties that they want to mark their territory, keep as many guys as they can in the Bay Area. And you see, you know, Ray McLeod up at Clemson that Jeff Scott was able to pull. There's a bunch of talented guys that go other places, and it's going to be tough to keep the homegrown guys in the city. And it's tough because, you know, Tampa's a metropolitan area. It's not what you would say a college town. People don't really want to stay in their hometown, especially when it's such a big city. And reasons, you know, USF's an afterthought. They're,
well, you see,
more
like this
Florida
too, where it is in Orlando and things. It's kind of the same deal.
Yeah, it comes down to if you really want to change the program, and that's what Willie Taggart hit home on with Marlon Mack when he got recruited in 2014. He was on the verge of flipping to Louisville, but he's Sarasota Manatee guy, got him to stay home, and then you're pulling guys from Miami like Quentin Flowers to kind of change the program. You just got to hit on some of the key guys, and the rest will kind of come along, and that's been missing for a few years.
What would you say is the biggest pro of the USF job and the biggest con?
Biggest pro? I would say since the announcement of the indoor practice facility back in February, they're going to break ground here probably in the next month. There's a lot of potential, a lot of untapped donor potential, especially with this IPF. That's been one of the things that's holding back USF. Once that gets up to par, I think Florida State announced on Wednesday they're, you know, building a new facility. It's,
they're quietly behind.
Arms race.
People don't realize, and it, FSU is quietly behind in the money department in the state of Florida.
Yeah, and you saw with Jimbo leaving for, you know, that ridiculous contract at A&M. It's all arms race, and USF finally getting in the game is going to be huge for them. And it doesn't hurt that you play at Ray J, where, you know, you just had WrestleMania, you had the Super Bowl, you've had the CFP there. It's a fantastic facility. They have their own locker room inside Ray J. It's not Buccaneers branded locker room. It's theirs that they use whenever. It's going to help. That's probably the best thing I could say about the USF job, is there's a lot of untapped potential. The worst part is the untapped potential. It's been 20 years of untapped potential, right? And eventually you either figure it out and crack that potential, you're just going to be, you know, cycling through, you know, 8 to 10 win seasons every once in a while when you hit on someone, and then you're back to the bottom where you're 3-9, 4-8 fighting for another bowl game. And I will say that the fan base is fickle. You know, I think people were annoyed at Jeff Scott, you know, this past season in our mentions and DMs, and
what were they,
you know, interactions. that he only won one game and lost eight straight.
Yeah. Well, that's also just like, I mean, they had some fight. They had some spunk in the UCF game. They almost beat Memphis. Cincinnati was relatively close, 28-7. Like, I mean, yeah, you got blown out by Tulsa. You got blown out by some teams you shouldn't have lost it. But, like, that whole, like, Temple was right there. Like you said, the cup board was bare. I don't think it was that bad. And I think ending on that kind of note with UCF was actually pretty positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know if you guys know Richard Johnson, the former SB Nation guy,
yes.
Split Zone Duo. He's very big on proof of concept. And I think that UCF game was a proof of concept that the offense can work when the pieces are there. And offensive coordinator Charlie Weiss Jr. has some pieces now. There's so much more talent from year one to year two already that it's going to be exciting to see when the offense kind of puts it together. The spring game, they threw for over 550 yards, you know, the split up defense, but four scholarship quarterbacks all threw for over 100 yards in limited action. It's better than what it has been, to say the least.
Interesting. Was it just recruiting with Charlie Strong as an outsider? Like, if you had to explain, is it anything more than just a recruiting issue? Or, like, why was the cup board so bare? And why did it just fail so spectacularly with Charlie Strong?
Well, Charlie Strong signed the contract after getting fired from Texas. So, you know, the first, I believe, 2 years were subsidized by Texas. So he wasn't making a lot of money. And he brought a lot of staff over from Texas, that same staff that got fired the previous year, and thought, we'll make it work. And they did make it work because USF had a lot of NFL talent. Mark Westfeldt, the Scantling, was on the team. Deidre Sanaa of the Atlanta Falcons was on the team. And, of course, Quentin Flowers. Well, you lose those guys in 2018. You bring in Blake Barnett. You miss on a quarterback. You chase away two other quarterbacks. And you're trotting out a walk-on in a blowout because you're down so many bodies. You only have two scholarship quarterbacks. And I believe it was 2019. It was just brutal. The recruiting was bad. I've heard from coaches, other coaches on staff that were on staff, that he just didn't go out and recruit.
That's just so weird. Like, him coming really in his pedigree and where he'd been, like, that's just so weird to me.
I think it's been said that between him and Kevin Sumlin just jumping into a job after getting fired from Texas schools and being black, I think that it's one of those things where if you don't get into another job, you may not get it again, which is one of the unfortunate downsides of college football and being a person of color. If you fail, there's a stigma that you're going to fail every other stop.
Yeah.
So I think he wanted to jump back in, and it just didn't work out for whatever reason. Very nice guy. I can't say enough about him, but it just didn't work here. I wish him well. And I think he may be good in Jacksonville as just a linebackers coach, I believe, is what he is now. So it happens. You just get a bad fit, and that just doesn't work out. I think you need to take some time off before jumping into another job.
You just don't know if that other job's coming, even if it means taking the Arizona job, which is one of the most unwinnable jobs in college football. Last thing, and we'll wrap up here. So we know a little bit about the quarterback position, but what spring position battles are you looking at? Is there skill position guys that you're excited about watching this fall? Who are going to be some USF darlings when I'm waking up early, Nathan, on Sunday morning, doing my scans, my views, my Victor's Valiant 11-minute clips of shout out to Victor's Valiant on YouTube. It's a godsend during the college football season of just parsing through USF games that I'm like, oh, this dude's awesome. I'm going to jot him down and shout him out on the podcast. Like, who makes that list for you?
Well, you know, right now, quarterback Cade Fortin, I think he's head and shoulders above the competition. There's still some good guys in there. Then fall camp is a completely different beast than spring, but it seemed like he's the guy. He threw for over 200 yards in the spring game. Again, spring game. But he hit on a couple of deep shots that were completely missing from the offense last year. I think it starts and ends with Cade Fortin. And the guys that he kind of started to connect with is Xavier Weaver, who kind of was below the radar. I think he had seven catches last season. But he's really improved his body technique, route running, and he was explosive in the spring game. I'll shoot you over a clip of what he did in the spring game. Just great catch. Shoot three guys, ran in for a score, caught another one. He's going to be a guy to watch. As I mentioned, Jimmy Horn Jr., who's not on campus yet, he's a true freshman from Samford, Florida. He's another guy to watch. Latrell Williams, former Tennessee wide receiver Latrell Williams, for I think he had a cup of coffee at Tennessee before transferring. He's been explosive. Gunnar Greenwald, true freshman tight end, he's looked good. May need to work on, you know, inline blocking a little bit more with how the offensive line kind of is shaping out to be. You need, you know, your running backs and tight ends to block a little bit better. Those three guys, I think, are what you want to be looking for, as well as Demario Dollison. He's a true freshman. He's a true sophomore. He's a guy who really stepped up and was great at, you know, those deep crossing routes, was able to stretch the field a little bit last year. And he had the shortest punt return for a touchdown ever against the Citadel to start the season, where he caught a blocked punt in the end zone for a touchdown. So that was nice.
Interesting. All right. Well, what can we check out from you this week at the Daily Stampede, or anything else you would like to plug, Nathan?
Yeah, we've got two episodes of our latest podcast up, the Blooming Eye podcast. We did kind of broke down football, and then second one broke down the Olympic sports, because I think there's like 14 other sports, spring sports going on right now. Our women's basketball team is fantastic. They made the second round of the NCAA tournament. Our women's soccer team is fantastic. They swept pretty much every award, and we'll be playing Thursday in their conference tournament, and we'll be covering that. And just check us out. We're decently okay funny and on Twitter sometimes at Stampede SBN, and just check us out at dailystampede.com.
All right, well, go do that and keep up the great work, Nathan. Thank you so much for making the time. I greatly appreciate it.
Not a problem. I appreciate it, Chase. Thanks for having me on.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.